Chapter 31. Mr. Jung. Carl Jung waited for her to check his identity while he concentrated on not fidgeting. Business attire had been the instruction. He hadn't worn anything remotely businesslike in the last decade. It took him 5 minutes and 6 restarts just to get the stupid necktie knotted, and already he wished he'd found a more comfortable pair of underwear. He wondered if he could duck into the bathroom and pull the damn things off, maybe stuff them into his bag. He decided against it. Parts of himself would brush an outline against the front of his trousers. It was unseemly.
"Just a moment, sir."
The lady behind the desk. The left hemisphere of her head had been shaved down to skin, while the right stood up in a forest of immaculately sculpted purple spikes. She had the dead stare of someone looking deep into the lens, and her fingers, each of which was tipped in a chromium-plated talon, ticked absently along the surface of her desk like a sleeping insectile monstrosity. A quote came to mind. He was pretty sure it was Russell. It went, "Love is wise, hatred is foolish. In this world, which is getting more and more closely interconnected, we have to learn to tolerate each other. We have to learn to put up with the fact that some people say things that we don't like. We can only live together in that way. But if we are to live together and not die together, we must learn a kind of charity and a kind of tolerance, which is absolutely vital to the continuation of human life on this planet." He'd been pondering that quote a lot lately.
"The conference room is nearly ready, Mr. Jung. Would you like to have a seat while you wait?"
Yes, thank you."
He shuffled over to a lobby chair, clutching vice-like at his bag in resistance of the urge to tug away at his trouser front. Once seated, he spread and closed his legs several times, crossed and straightened them, and shifted around in hopes of certain bits and pieces rolling over to a position approaching tolerable. He only made it worse. Things had gone wrapped around the axle, as his great-grandfather had been fond of saying. It occurred to him that all the wiggling in his seat probably drew more attention than just dealing with the problem directly, so he reached down, pinched some fabric, and gave a good tug. The situation down there unspun and flopped out proper, arranging into a natural configuration that was blessedly neutral. Not as comfortable as the clothes he normally wore, but tolerable. He glanced at the lady behind the desk and felt a hot flash roll through his chest. She was looking right at him. He looked away quickly, counted silently to himself, then peeked at her again. He tried to limit how far he turned his head to do so, but he had to turn it just a little all the same. She was still looking dead at him. For a moment, he hesitated. Her eyes still had the unfocused lens stare, and he thought it might have been that she didn't even notice. Then she smiled demurely and directed her gaze toward her desktop. Carl sighed through his nose.
"Look around first, then make adjustments," he admonished himself.
He focused on not being annoyed. Carl Jung did not do well in public.
"Busted,"
whispered a man 2 meters to his right. Carl looked at him. Younger, wearing a suit like his own, though more fashionable. No necktie. Carl shrugged it off. It was an archaic piece of clothing that went in and out of style with the rapidity of a meme, but it was always safer to wear one. When they were out of fashion, no one really noticed if you wore it anyway. They were too ingrained in the public consciousness. It was like the fedora, which seemed to come back with a vengeance every 30 years or so.
"Sure, people like to wind out with the crazy stuff," Carl mused. "They like their strange hair and body mods and their AR overlays. But for some reason, we always seem to find our way back to the old things. I wonder why that is."
"Papa Simmons."
The young man in the fashionable suit again. Carl suspected he'd just been given a name. He looked over at him. The young man held out an elbow suspended in the emptiness between them. Carl grunted to himself, a sound of mild puzzlement, and bumped his own elbow against it.
"Pleased," he said.
Simmons nodded, withdrew his arm, and absently wiped the hand down his lapel as if they'd made real contact. He waited silently a moment, then said, "And you?"
"Sorry, Carl. Carl Jung."
Simmons's brow perked.
"I've seen that name on a few of our messages. You're pretty high up, eh?"
"I wouldn't know."
"Yeah, bullshit," he chuckled,
and leaned his head back to stare at the ceiling in a self-satisfied way. Carl closed his eyes and thought,
"We must learn a kind of charity and a kind of tolerance, which is absolutely vital to the continuation of human life on this planet."
"I'm with New Pont," Simmons offered, eyes closed, "heading up filtration and atmospheric regulation. And I know who you're with, so I guess I don't need to ask in your case."
He let the statement hang out there in the open like a chunk of bloody flesh dangling above a shark's nose. Carl loosened his tie, unbuttoned his collar, and sighed.
"Excuse me, gentlemen. Another few minutes and you'll be able to board the shuttle."
"Thank you," Carl said. He meant it.
"Hey, let me ask you something, Boss Jung."
"Oh, Christ.
I've always had a passing interest in the stuff you folks are doing over there. I kind of fancy myself something of an armchair physicist. But I was wondering, what was it that your team finally did to bring the ELMs under control?"
He was asking about edge-localized modes in the early Tomahawk prototypes. Despite his budding dislike, Carl was mildly impressed. Maybe Simmons actually knew something. The way he'd asked, as if they were picking up an old conversation, most people wouldn't open like that unless they knew the subject. If they were clueless, they typically sallied with some sort of preamble, an upfront of technical vomit designed to demonstrate their credentials. Most of the PMs he dealt with were like that. In most cases, the only thing they really understood was that you turned the magnets on, the plasma was contained, and the lights started working. But it was an odd question. ELMs hadn't been a technical barrier for a very long time. Simmons was either a historian of some sort, or just trying to burn time with empty conversation. Carl detested empty conversation.
"Modeling," he said.
Simmons stared at him, clearly expecting more. When he didn't get it, he offered an exaggerated shrug and said,
"Modeling? That's it?"
"It was really good modeling."
Carl looked away and blinked on a stream to distract himself. He was tangentially aware of Simmons's annoyed recoil, a disgusted mutter before the young man directed his attention elsewhere.
"Now he dislikes me," Carl thought. "Good. It'll minimize these little interactions going forward."
He turned it over to a random news channel and absorbed for a while. 3 new riots broken out, 2 on opposite ends of the country, and the last erupting in D.C., adding to the existing sit-ins, demonstrations, and marches already packing the streets of that little burg. They fought over the usual: racial equality, ideology, social justice, inequity. The great argument seemed always reducible to the same fundamental problem. One group of people had either too much or too little of a thing they wanted, while an opposing group had too much or too little of that same thing in the other direction. The people in charge proposed to right the wrongs by taking the various things and redistributing them around like a social shell game, all the while pocketing a fat percentage for themselves with every transaction. And the harder everyone fought, the worse things became.
"What was it you said, Albert? Insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different outcome, right? Well, you called it, Doc."
He might have wished the man had applied that intellect to solving humanity rather than special relativity, but Carl suspected the former was insoluble.
"Everyone fighting over the car, and in the meanwhile, those who should care the most aren't concerned over who's being handed the keys," he murmured.
"What's that, boss?"
"Nothing."
"Excuse me, sirs. The shuttle's ready. You're free to board."
Carl nodded, collected his bag, ignored Simmons, and went to stand at the desk. He looked down at the lady's nameplate, an oddity made anachronistic by the lenses. He had only to glance at her to manifest the information. Chartrella Pellery. Old-fashioned name, though not quite as old-fashioned as Carl. Out of curiosity, he enabled the AR overlay option and looked at her. She appeared to be about 20 years younger, 30 pounds lighter, and covered in pearlescent scales.
Dragon skin, he thought.
Virtual armor. He felt sorry for her. He thought she must be very sad. A door at the other end of the lobby opened. Carl nodded to the lady at the desk, even as he silently disabled the AR feature. She looked better without it. She smiled, nodded back at him, and her eyes dipped toward his crotch before quickly looking away. He felt heat bloom in his stomach as he hurried through the door. On the other side was the passenger compartment of the shuttle, a classic maglev rendered cheap to operate at the advent of sustainable fusion-based energy. He walked to the far end of the compartment where only 2 seats were located. He occupied one and set his bag in the other. He continued to ignore Simmons, who arranged himself halfway down the tube.
Another tube, he thought.
Lately, his life had consisted of nothing but tubes. Then the shuttle lifted, lurched forward, and surged from the loading bay like an antique dragster. His body dug into the seat cushion at first, then slackened as the pressure came off. The length of the shuttle's body was housed in a translucent carboglass shell and offered a spectacular view of Peripatetia Industries launch site A7, a compound of support buildings, offices, control centers, and various apparatus dedicated to the near-constant stream of booster craft running between the center of the complex, like missiles fired from a wagon spoke, Carl often thought to himself, and the great twin cans in the sky. He at first resisted the urge to look up through the ceiling of the shuttle, he would soon be up there anyway, and, as always, failed. He looked up. There it was, floating along in the geosynchronous orbit just as it always had. It had been up there for as long as he could remember, first as a framework visible only through the assistance of telescopics. Now he was working on the damned thing's power plant, and it was visible to the naked eye. The organizations that had come together to build the damned thing had named it the Ark, a painfully obvious and overburdened analogy to Carl's way of thinking. It carried a certain religious baggage to which he objected on general principle, and a sense of hope he wasn't certain they could promise.
If they wanted to go biblical, why not the diaspora? Carl mused. The Jews were rejected from the promised land, and now here we are ejecting ourselves from the only land we've ever known. Willingly. Oy vey.
He wondered how they could morally ship out on such a technological marvel in search of greener pastures when, with all of their wondrous technology, they had failed to solve the simple problems. Fusion had created cheap, safe, sustainable energy, sure enough, and yet the industrialized Middle East belched tons of carbon into the atmosphere by the day. As usual, agreements to share certain technology with that part of the world always managed to break down right as leaders prepared to put pen to paper. Always there was the fear of weaponization. Then there was all that near-free energy running rampant through the technologized world. The unfortunate little population boom that followed. The unfortunate little population boom that was not so little. People stacked upon each other like sardines in the major cities of even the most prosperous countries. Fund managers now invested in meat the way they used to invest in oil before the commodity had suffered its first true collapse. More and more people in Canada were living off protein substitutes, unable to take part in the consumption of their own cattle exports. How could they? It was too damned expensive. Even the lab-grown garbage went for upwards of $450 per ounce, and the only thing the lab-grown garbage was better than was nothing at all. He looked at the jewel cylinders high overhead and reflected on how his entire life had become composed of compartmentalized cylinders.
Silos. Grain silos. Great space-bound meat silos. We were better off sorting it all out down here before looking to fuck it up out there.
And now they wanted to hand the keys over to the Q-brains. It seemed humanity was just abdicating all across the board. Well, fine. Maybe that's all they were ever meant for. Maybe being in charge was only ever an experiment anyway. An experiment doomed to fail. What did it matter to him? He was nearly at the end of his run. He couldn't possibly have many years left in the tank. Tank? No, tank is the wrong word. They were only using tanks in the Middle East and parts of Asia anymore. His kind ran on cells now. They ran on cells, and his was growing grumpy and stubborn about holding a charge.
Won't be your problem before long. The next generation will figure it out, if they don't kill everything first.
Carl Jung lurched forward as the shuttle hit the deceleration stage. He could feel his stomach trying to escape through his mouth, took a deep breath and shoved it into his belly. It seemed to help. A few moments after that, they were sliding gently into the opposing dock at the center of the wagon wheel. He glanced at the timestamp overlay to the bottom left of his lens HUD. 10 miles in just over a minute and a half. It was an uninteresting bit of trivia he could not resist collecting. When he reached to take his bag, it was gone. In its place was a woman of African descent, a stunning example of genetic perfection in every line, ratio, and conceivable measure. He could not remember having ever encountered such an example in all of his years, not even in the streams which were already as doctored and facile as only modern technology could make them. He was immediately certain she'd been cocktailed in some lab, an experiment in ego on the part of well-meaning, albeit disgustingly rich, parents.
"Udo," she said, "there is much left to be done. You must come back now."
"Who? I'm sorry you have me mistaken with someone else. Please don't be offended, but where did you come from?"
Instead of answering, she asked,
"You're certain your name is Carl Jung?"
"It's never been anything else."
She looked ahead to the far end of the shuttle. A door had opened in the bulkhead.
"Better go catch your flight then, Carl."
He couldn't tear his eyes away from her as he left. He'd never seen her before, but maybe he had. He tripped on the way out, caught himself, and turned back to see if she'd noticed. But she was gone.